between which the crate stood. Having done this, he then brought the ends of the three ropes together and spliced them into a single rope. This he tied with a slipknot to a tree about 20 yards in front of the crates, where he intended to wait inside his Land Rover. Thus, if the three cubs entered separate crates, all he had to do was to release the rope and all three trapdoors would fall simultaneously. The first thing to do was to accustom the cubs to feed in the crates, and then wait for the critical moment. The cubs did not show any fear of the large boxes. Gopher even sat inside one of them while he ate his meal. It looked as though we might capture them fairly soon. Meanwhile, we wanted to remove the arrowhead from Jesper's rump. To do this would involve confining Jesper in a crate, and then using a local anaesthetic of the freezing spray type. George hoped that it could be done after the three cubs were trapped, and before they started the journey to the Serengeti. So, to get the spray and some chains for our four-wheel drive vehicles, I set off for Iziolo with Ibrahim. The sky was black, and there was plainly more rain coming, so I was in a great hurry to get back before conditions got any worse. Luckily, it only took me one day to make my purchases. I also rang up John Berger, the Narrow Moru vet, and one at Nairobi, both living along the route we should take with the cubs, and asked them if they would operate on Jesper if we passed at a convenient time, for I was doubtful whether the freezing spray would take effect on Jesper's thick pelt, and didn't want to risk an operation that might be a failure. Among the mail I'd collected at Iziolo, I found press cuttings with most alarming headlines. Elsa's cubs may have to be shot. Death threat to Elsa's cubs. Elsa's cubs sentenced to death. I was terrified. The reports stated that Major Grimwood had told reporters in Nairobi that he had instructed George to try to capture the cubs and transfer them to a game reserve, and that if he failed to do so, he must shoot them. That Major Grimwood should tell the press that he was giving such an order without first informing us was utterly unlike him. I felt sure then, as I afterwards discovered to be true, that the press had misunderstood what he had told them. I knew, of course, that if the cubs scratched anyone, even slightly, they would be sentenced to death. Mercifully, they had not done so, but it was vital to move them as soon as possible. Soon after my arrival, George told me that the cubs had come every night, and that each had entered a crate to eat the meat he had placed in it. Jesper had even spent a whole night inside one of them. The trouble was that sometimes two cubs would get into the same box. Would they ever, all three, be at the same time in a position which would make it possible for us to capture them? We were full of hope that our anxieties might be nearing an end, when the mail brought us a bombshell. George received a letter from the district commissioner, in whose area we now stayed, containing an ultimatum to capture the cubs within a stated period. The DC added that he was sorry to have to give this order, but since the situation was being exploited politically, he could not give us his support after this date. We were most distressed, for although we believed that we were nearing the time when we might hope to capture the cubs, we were working under great handicaps. My injured leg, sickness amongst our staff, and finally there was the possibility that at any moment heavy rains might stop us. The one satisfactory thing was that for the last 9 days, the cubs had ceased raiding Boma's and come every night to George for their food. That night they did not appear. We spent the next day improving the trapping device, rehearsing our parts in the capture. In spite of these occupations, the hours seemed to drag until it was time to sit up for the cubs. I'd barely finished putting the terrymycin into the meat lumps when Jesper appeared. He ate two of them, and then came and sat in front of our cars and watched. Meanwhile, his brother and sister entered separate crates. A little later, they came out and lay near Jesper. They looked very lovely in the bright moonlight, and I longed to remove them from the dangers which were increasing. But as if to mock me, a lion chose this moment to roar, and the cubs went off like a flash. I heard a hearty curse from George's car. Another of the few remaining knights was lost. Resigned, I went to lie on my bed, asking George to call me when it was my turn to keep watch, or before that if anything should happen. I felt very depressed, but was so tired that I dozed off. Suddenly, I was woken by the crashing of the crate doors. A deathly silence followed. It was as if all life had suddenly stopped. After a short time, the struggle inside the crates began. Simultaneously, George and I ran to them, quickly removed the wooden blocks we'd placed below the doors to prevent any damage to protruding tails, and closed the narrow slits so as to remove any opportunity for leverage and make an attempt to escape impossible. Although it was an immense relief to know that the cubs were now safe, both George and I felt disgusted at the deception we had practiced on them. Very grateful for the way in which George single-handed had effected the difficult capture, I kissed him, but he only gave a sad smile. Now there was no time to lose if we wished to reduce the cubs' time of discomfort and bewilderment to a minimum. George remained on guard, and I went back to camp, woke the men, told them the news, then together we hurriedly packed up so as to be ready to hoist the cubs on the truck at first light. When all was ready, we drove the Bedford to the crates. George told me that after Jesper had recovered from the shock of finding himself trapped, he'd calmed down and spent most of the night sitting quietly in his box. Little Elsa had followed his example, but Gopa had gone on fighting for a long time. Now he was growling savagely at our boys, who had come to help in hoisting the crates on the truck, each of which weighed well over 800 pounds. During the operation, the Africans, to induce the necessary impetus, shouted in rhythm, which terrified the excited cubs. As the heavy boxes lifted by block and tackle dangled in the air, the lions paced to and fro, causing the crates to sway alarmingly. We hoisted little Elsa first. Her crate, placed lengthwise to the side of the truck, filled half its breadth. Gopa we placed alongside her, and his crate filled the other half. Both their wooden doors faced the back of the driver's cab. Jesper's crate we placed broadside along the end of the lorry. In this way the cubs had the fullest view of each other, only separated by the bars of the cages. In their present state, they would not touch any food, so there was no chance of giving them tranquilizers. Luckily, we knew that they had all had a good meal, and we had secured meat in each crate, as well as a water container which we refilled before covering the lorry with a ground sheet to protect the cubs from any low branches which might hit the truck during the journey. We were ready to move. I took a last look to make sure that everything was in order. Jasper's expression of despair was almost unendurable. Heavy clouds were gathering on every side. We were surrounded by a threatening black wall. Skidding through mud, we raced this colossal storm for 60 miles and won by only a hair's breadth. At dusk, we reached the district HQ, left a message for the district commissioner, telling him our good news, and then pressed on. When we passed the boundary of the district, I took a very deep breath. The cubs were now outside the jurisdiction of the death sentence. It was 9 in the evening before we reached a little township, where there was the vet, who might be able to operate on Jesper. Even though the hour was so late, John Berger very kindly offered to try to extract the arrowhead there and then, but he was unable to do so because Jesper, when he saw the stranger, got into a rage and would not allow him to come near enough to administer the anaesthetic. The vet comforted me by saying that he thought if we waited for 2 or 3 weeks, the arrow might well slough out by itself. In any case, the wound was only skin deep, looked perfectly healthy, and was not interfering with any vital function. In case the arrow did not come out of itself, he lent me some extra long bullet forceps, gave me some antiseptic, and suggested that we might be able to pull it out later on if Jesper allowed us to perform the operation. We gratefully accepted the vet's offer of coffee, as we had had nothing to eat or drink since breakfast. Warmed up, we pushed on. Dawn found us a few miles short of Namanga, close to the Tanganyika border. Here we allowed ourselves a brief rest and warmed ourselves with hot tea. The cubs were completely exhausted and lay apathetically in their cages, their faces chafed by the constant friction against the bars. The meat inside the crates was very high and covered with maggots, so we tried to remove it with iron scrapers, but the carcasses had been so securely fastened to the bars that we could not remove them. All we could do was to give the cubs fresh meat and water, in which they showed no interest. To reduce the length of their misery as much as we could, we decided that I should drive full speed ahead to Arusha, 100 miles distant, announce our arrival to the director of the national parks, and find out the location of the release point in the Serengeti. It was a lovely morning, and I watched last night's clouds disperse to disclose Mount Kilimanjaro rising above the early mist. Its cap of newly fallen snow looked so ethereal in the morning light that it was difficult to believe that it was a glacier-crowned volcano. I've often admired Kilimanjaro from a distance, and I've climbed to its summit, but today more than ever it seemed a manifestation of glory, remote from the troubled world of man. Part of the grandeur of an unspoiled creation, of which animals were an integral part. With this thought in my mind, I was sorry to see only 3 giraffe and a few impala antelope on plains where a few years ago wildlife abounded. The increasing traffic along the new tarmac road had driven the animals away, and I reflected that at the moment I myself was one of these destructive motorists. But at least my presence was justified by the hope of providing the cubs with a natural life, unthreatened by man. I thought, too, that the length of time during which sanctuaries, such as the national parks, will be able to give refuge to wild animals will depend not only on the sympathy and active help of a few dedicated people, but on the support of all who live in Africa, whatever their race may be. This made me all the more determined to use the money coming to me from the sale of books about Elsa and her cubs to subsidize preservation schemes. At Arusha, I saw the director of the national parks, and we discussed the locality of the release point. I was surprised when he suggested Serenera, as it is the HQ of the park, and where all the park staff live, and is also a centre for tourists. I pleaded for a more remote location, and the director agreed that we might take them further afield to an area near a river which never went dry. He very kindly promised to send a radio message to one of the park wardens, asking him to meet us on our way and guide us to this spot. After leaving the director, it took me 5 hours to find George, who had driven the lorry 60 miles beyond Arusha. This meant that we should not be able to reach the Serengeti by nightfall. So we camped on Umtu Ya Umba at the foot of the Manyara escarpment. At first light, I roused the camp, which did not make me popular, but I was determined that the cubs should be released from their misery as soon as possible. Concentrating on speed, we climbed steadily into the highlands of the giant volcanoes. At last we reached the rim of the Ngorongoro crater, and we saw far below us the Serengeti plain. Ahead of us lay undulating slopes, so profusely covered with bright yellow senecios that they might have been made of gold. We came down rapidly to an altitude of 5,000 feet. As the heat increased, we removed the tarpaulins which covered the lorry to prevent the cubs from suffocating. But this resulted in their raw wounds being covered with dust. They were having a terrible time, for they were bounced about mercilessly as the lorry lurched from one pothole to another. We had to stop often to jack the vehicles out of deep holes and replace broken springs. We were 2 hours late when we reached Nabi Hill, at which we were to meet the park warden. The poor man had spent the time watching our convoy, creeping along like a caterpillar, raising a trail of dust in its wake. We had to cut our greeting short. The heavy storm clouds were gathering, and we still had a long way to go through black cotton soil, the worst ground to cross when wet. On our way, we passed vast herds of wildebeest and zebra. These were only the forerunners of the annual migration, but neither of us had ever before seen such an assembly of wild animals. dodging between the herds and avoiding swampy patches, we reached the release point in the late afternoon. The cubs' new home was a very beautiful place, lying at the head of a broad valley some 40 miles long. On one side, a steep escarpment rose to a plateau. On the other, there was a succession of hills. Close by was a river, which gradually wound its way to the centre of the valley and flowed down it. Its banks were covered with dense undergrowth and fine trees, which provided perfect cover for the animals. The valley looked like a park, with clusters of thorn trees and bush, which higher up the hills increased in density. But for the mosquitoes and the tsetse flies, it was a paradise, and perhaps we ought to have regarded the tsetse as its winged guardians, for they are the best protectors of wild animals. Since they are fatal to men and to their livestock, they cause them to keep away. Our first thought was to see what we could do to make the cubs more comfortable. We chose a stout acacia tree, attached the block and tackle to one of its branches, and swung the crates to the ground. It was 3 days since the cubs had been captured, and they'd almost reached the limit of their endurance. Their eyes were deeply sunken, and they lay apathetically on the floor of their cages, apparently too tired to take the least interest in their surroundings. How glad we were that we had decided to bring the cumbersome communal crate, in which they would be able to recover from the strain of the journey. After opening the back of it, we placed little Elsa's and Gopa's boxes with their doors opposite the opening. Then, with block and tackle, we raised the trap doors of the cages. For a few moments nothing happened. Then suddenly, Gopa rushed into little Elsa's box. He sat on her, and they licked and hugged each other, overwhelmed with joy at being reunited. Quickly we closed the door behind them, and replaced Gopa's empty crate by the one containing Jasper. The instant we opened this door, he was out like a flash, and covered his brother and sister as if to protect them from further disaster, and started to lick and embrace them. As we watched them, we became more than ever convinced that we had done well to move the cubs in crates which allowed them to see each other. This had probably resulted in some extra chafing, but it would be easier to heal wounds than broken spirits. Now we had to see that they got rested and made up for their lost meals. We put a carcass into the communal crate, told our men to camp a little way off, and parked our Land Rovers right and left of the crate to protect the cubs from any prowlers that came by night. By 9 p.m, all this had been done, and while we were eating, the park warden came to discuss our camping arrangements. The park authorities had kindly given us permission to look after the cubs until they had settled in their new home and could fend for themselves. The park warden told us that meanwhile we could feed them on game animals shot outside Serengeti Park. The next morning, when we went to the cubs, we found all three lying in the communal crate. Their faces were a shocking sight, for the big cage was made of weld mesh wire, which chafed them even more than the iron bars of the travelling crates. Every time they pressed against it, their wounds reopened. The sun was rising, and as soon as it got hot, flies appeared and literally covered the cubs. Poor Jasper kept brushing one front paw against his sores, while with the other he hugged little Elsa. After breakfast, George drove off to shoot a kill outside the Serengeti, while I remained with the cubs. Whenever he gave me an opportunity to do so, I tried to remove the arrow from Jasper's rump. He did not mind even when I pinched the skin and tugged as hard as I could, but the barb remained jammed. Later in the morning, the plague of flies made the cubs very restless. They paced up and down, rubbing their heads against the wire and reopening their wounds. But in the end, they cuddled up together, looking at me reproachfully. I knew the Serengeti was by far the best home we could have found for the cubs, but the climate and the ecological conditions were very different from those of their old home, and most of the local animals belonged to species unknown to them. Even the local lions were of a different subspecies from theirs. What would their mutual reactions be, and what trouble might arise over territorial rights? Since there was so much game about,